in 2005, under President George W. Bush, mandates required oil companies to add ethanol to their gasoline. Ethanol was seen as a cleaner fuel that could help cut reliance on foreign oil.
As the eighth largest ethanol-producing state, this transition has had an impact on agriculture and land use here in Wisconsin.
A report out today, it's gotten a lot of attention. It's by the Associated Press, and it questions whether ethanol has achieved its goals, says the industry has harmed the environment and decreased conservation land in the process. With us now is one of the reporters who broke the story, Dina Capiello. She's the national environmental reporter for Associated Press in Washington, and the report is called The Secret Dirty Cost of Obama's Green Power Push. Dina, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So we mentioned that some of these mandates started before President Obama, but he gave it a boost. Talk about how President Obama committed to ethanol as an alternative fuel.
Well, obviously, you know, let's go back to when he was a senator from Illinois. He was very supportive of policies that would incorporate ethanol and gasoline. Then he started to run for president, was a big supporter of ethanol in Iowa during, obviously, the very pivotal caucuses. We talked to one of his campaign advisors at the time who said it was one way that he distinguished himself from the field. And so obviously he played a big role in his election. He's been a longtime supporter before getting into the White House. And now as president, while of course he didn't sign this bill into law, that was President George W. Bush, it's his administration that has actually been the one to implement it. And actually the EPA and the RFS is one of the first, you know, major environmental undertakings that his administration did when he got into office.
And what's the argument? What's been the logic behind adding ethanol to the gasoline we use in all our cars?
Well, the original argument was twofold. One was to wean ourselves off foreign oil. Let's remember, I mean, back in 2007, oil prices were really high. And the second major argument for ethanol was that it would be better than petroleum-based gasoline from a greenhouse gas emissions perspective. And so those were the two primary arguments when this law was passed. But a lot of things have changed since those initial arguments were made.
So what are some of the things that have changed since they first made that case?
Well, for one, we're importing, you know, far less foreign oil than we were in 2007, in large part because our country is producing a lot more homegrown oil and gas because of techniques to get at tight oil. For instance, in the Bakken shale of North Dakota, we fuel efficiency standards have improved our gasoline mileage, so we're actually using less gasoline as a country, and so all of these things weren't factored in, and then. Obviously, even on greenhouse gas emissions, because of the recession, we are doing better on those from an energy standpoint.
So the marquee finding in your study has been the impact of ethanol requirements on how much corn farmers are growing and, in turn, on our land. Can you talk about that a little, please?
No, absolutely. So obviously, you know, corn ethanol created a huge new market for corn here in the U.S. and helps drive up corn prices. And, you know, any smart farmer who sees prices go up on a commodity says, maybe I should start planting it. And that's indeed what happened. I mean, since the ethanol mandate was passed, we have 15 million more acres of corn in this country. And that had to go somewhere. And some of that was crop switching, but some of that was also conversion, two kinds of conversion. One, from land that was long fallowed in a conservation reserve program where farmers were paid to actually fallow environmentally sensitive land. And then in addition, we also found evidence through the USDA and through our own analysis of actually people breaking in to, you know, what we would call native or virgin grasslands that haven't been in crop or row crop before. So, and that has a lot of environmental consequences. First and foremost, obviously, anybody that's seen, you know, a farmer turn over a field, obviously you're exposing the soil, there's soil runoff. A lot of these places where corn is being grown are on marginal soils that are not great for the crop. That drives fertilizer use. That runs into waterways, causing algal blooms and problems for water supplies, like the Des Moines Water Works that you mentioned in our story. And then it also has, all of that change has a greenhouse gas impact. When you apply nitrogen to fields, that releases nitrous oxide. It's a very powerful greenhouse gas. And actually taking out the grass and replacing it with corn also releases greenhouse gases. So there is a greenhouse gas consequence to that as well.
So not surprisingly, there's been some angry response to your report today and even before it came out. And one of those, there have been a bunch of arguments. One says, no, land isn't going from the Conservation Reserve Program to corn because of ethanol. It's because funding was cut to the Conservation Reserve Program when Congress couldn't pass a farm bill. Is that part of the factor, or are you seeing it's more the corn ethanol?
Well, listen, and this is a kind of a chicken and egg argument, and obviously we've seen the criticism about our piece. You know, I talked to the lawmakers on the Hill that worked on the 2008 Farm Bill and are working on the current Farm Bill, and, you know, what they would say is that the lowering of the CRP cap was a response to market forces, that farmers didn't really want to enroll in the program, that, you know, that prices had gone up in part because of the ethanol mandate, in part because of international demand, and they wanted to plant corn. And actually, if you look at testimony that was given in June to Congress by the USDA chief economist, I mean, he actually makes this point that ethanol indeed helped drive up corn prices, and in turn, that led to some land conversion.
I wanted to ask you about Wisconsin. Obviously, this is part of why we're talking about it here. Wisconsin is a big corn state, not the biggest, but and ethanol has been an issue here, too. What kind of things did you find out about Wisconsin?
Well, we looked, obviously, what we basically did was we looked at both corn acreage before the mandate went into effect, which was in 2006, and compared it to 2012, which is the latest full data set we had available. And when you do that for the state of Wisconsin, in that time frame, so from 06 to 2012, there was 700,000 additional acres put into corn. In addition, for each state, we also looked at what happened to the conservation land. And there are actually 9 counties in Wisconsin that lost more than half of their conservation land in that same time frame. Now, obviously, one of the big challenges in reporting a piece like this is it's very difficult because you can't really get down to the farm level because of privacy concerns to figure out exactly what acre of CRP was lost and what it went into. So what we had to do is we had to just look at those two variables. Where did corn go up and where was CRP lost, not only on a statewide basis but on a county basis, which is the smallest kind of area we could look at.
And what did you find county by county? Did you find in particular counties conservation land goes down, corn goes up?
We did in some counties. Again, as I said, there were 9. We published a list of counties in the Corn Belt that saw some of the biggest changes, and 9 of Wisconsin's counties were on that list. And all of them had lost half or more of their conservation land since the corn ethanol mandate came to be.
And the logical conclusion you're thinking is corn prices go up in part because of the ethanol requirement, way outpaces the conservation money from the federal government. It's a logical choice for farmers.
Absolutely. And farmers told us that. They told us that in Iowa. They told us that in South Dakota, that they made that decision. Now, obviously, as you all know, being from, you know, an agricultural state and an ethanol state, you know, there are good actors and there are bad actors. And a lot of farmers are planting more corn, not only for ethanol, but for other reasons, and doing conservation practices that mitigate the impact, right? Whether that's waterways, whether that's buffers to reduce soil runoff, but some aren't. And you know, we saw the consequences of that on the ground in Iowa.
We're talking to Dina Capiello. She's national environmental reporter for the Associated Press in Washington, D.C. We're talking about the AP's new report on the impact of ethanol mandates.
And we'd like to hear your thoughts on this. Do you grow corn or are you involved in the ethanol industry? Have you seen the effects of the ethanol industry in your own town? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're back with Dina Capiello, the National Environmental Reporter for the Associated Press in Washington, D.C. We're talking about the impact of ethanol production on the environment.
And you can join the discussion at 800-642-1234. Do you grow corn? Are you involved in the ethanol industry? Do you have an opinion on whether ethanol should be required in our gasoline? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to the phones. We've got Jim with us now in Iowa County. Jim, hi, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. Hello?
Yep. What did you want to bring up, Jim?
Oh, sure. I'm the county conservationist in Iowa County, and over the last 4.5 years, we've had 23 square miles come out of CRP, which had to be highly erodible land, shallow soils and slopy land, mm-hmm. and 23 square miles probably all went into corn and beans. I'm glad to hear you're having a conversation about the environmental effects of growing corn and beans. And historically, we used to, the USDA used to factor in soil loss as a cost of production, and they don't do that anymore. So we're having a real challenge out here to working with farmers on raising corn and beans on sensitive soils and encouraging no-till waterways and buffers, as your guest had mentioned. So I'm real glad you're having this conversation, and I was glad to see the article in today's paper.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Jim. So that's, he mentioned the CRP, the Conservation Reserve Program. He's seeing what you're talking about there.
That's exactly right. I mean, that is, I mean, if it wasn't a county in Wisconsin, he could have been calling from southern Iowa where we were. I mean, a very, very similar story. It's a very, you know, slightly kind of hilly landscape. Very highly erodible soils, not great for corn, and it's going into corn. And we talk to conservationists that are struggling like he is to kind of get every farmer on board. And we actually went to a Rathbun Lake, which is one of the, I think it's the largest rural water supply in the country. And they literally, the managers of the water supply, are actually mapping the land use conversion and actually have rated where people are converting and saying, this is really high priority because this is going into our waterways. And they're going out and they're one by one talking to those farmers and trying to convince them to do these conservation practices, which we all know work to mitigate some of these impacts.
And you're seeing, you wrote about nitrate pollution in a lot of waterways that towns rely on.
Absolutely. I mean, we talked to the Des Moines Water Works, which, you know, for the first time this year, both of the rivers that supply its water had high nitrates. Usually in years past, one is high and it can go to the other one. But this year, both of them had high nitrate levels, and they actually had to turn on these huge machines, very expensive, very energy intensive, to filter out the nitrates. And they also showed us data looking at the trend line in terms of the nitrate concentrations in their water sources, and the trend line is up since the ethanol boom, in large part because of the land conversion that has happened. And we're not saying I want to make something very clear to people. Obviously, you know, this mandate has caused people to take, you know, fields that were in wheat and plant them to corn. There's been crop switching. And we're talking about both direct and indirect land use changes. I mean, direct meaning that people are, you know, planting corn that goes into an ethanol plant and becomes ethanol and goes into a gasoline plant. But because of the share of the corn market, more corn has to be planted for other purposes. And that's where you get kind of the indirect land use change that we've talked about.
Thanks for the call, Jim. We'll go to Jackie now in Sun Prairie. Jackie, hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. I am a farmer's daughter whose father put, maybe 40 good acres into conservation, we used to call it. And the land was marginal and somewhat marshy. But the question I have, though, is that I read the paper today, the article in the paper, and it seemed to not only imply, it stated that it was the result of the Obama administration. And I wondered if that was the intent of the people who wrote it, or how much influence does the Obama administration have on this whole business of repurposing that land again back to corn?
Well, the reason why we focus on, it's a very good question, by the way. Obviously, you know, the President George W. Bush signed this into law, but the implementation of that law, the rules that are written to make that law work, were done all under Obama. And I think as we talk about in the article, some of the things that they put in place to police the environmental consequences, especially the land use and what we call new breaking, which is your farmer's daughter, you know what I mean, when you're breaking ground that hasn't been planted before, actually mask the problem. So I think that we talk about the Obama administration, not only because it's him in the White House and he's been a big supporter of the RFS and the ethanol mandate, but because it was some of the decisions that his administration made in terms of how we're going to keep track of the environmental consequences that aren't doing a great job seeing the issue. In addition to the land use change, we point out in the article that the law required the EPA, and this would be under Obama, the EPA to do air quality and water quality studies, you know, independent, them doing it, not relying on prior research. And that has not actually happened.
Speaking of the Obama administration, his agriculture secretary, Tom Vilsack, responded to the report saying, while conservation land has declined in that conservation reserve program, all of conservation has not declined. They say there are other kinds of land, wetlands in part, going back into conservation. Is that true? Do you buy that?
It is true, but you have to remember there are different types of conservation land. So we looked at CRP. Why did we look at CRP? Because CRP is fallowed cropland that's in there for a decade, sometimes more if they renew the contract. It's really allowed to return to its natural state. It's not. It's minimally managed, if managed at all. What the secretary was talking about, and he made the same point when he spoke to ethanol lobbyists here on the Hill, is other conservation programs that are put in place on actually active farmland. And that's a whole different, you know, ball of wax, for lack of a better term. We looked at CRP lands because they are fallowed and they are natural, and there is a consequence to converting them. What he was talking about when he talks about CSP and EQIP are conservation programs that actually happen on active farmland that is being cropped.
Gotcha. We'll go back to the phones now. We've got Roger with us in Wanakee. Roger, hi.
Thanks for taking the call. What a beautiful subject to be broaching. I've just got back from South Dakota a couple of weeks ago, and in the pheasant population, wildlife, deer, pheasants are down in some areas 80% in the last couple of years. They've had bad winters, but a lot of it is just because this grassland is just being removed from the system and put into corn. Driving down the road, you're looking at this native prairie. It's never been plowed, ever. And the land is going into corn at a rate that's unprecedented in the last 100 years. It just breaks your heart to see that.
And all right, Roger, thanks. I want to get a response from Dina. So converting this this prairie land into cropland and its impact on wildlife.
Absolutely. Hey, Roger. Hey, I love the segue. That's a great segue for me. We actually have another piece that is going to be hitting the wire at 12:01 a.m. on Wednesday morning, actually anchored in South Dakota, talking about grassland conversion. We actually did a satellite analysis using both agricultural satellite data, USDA agricultural satellite data, and also the U.S. Geological Survey data to kind of get to that grassland conversion you're talking about. And we're not talking about CRP, right, which is once cropland. We are talking about native grasslands that as far as we know, have never been cropped. And we looked at actually just kind of the Corn Belt. And what we found in our analysis, and we actually subtracted CRP to be very conservative and not double count it, is that 1.2 million acres of grasslands has gone into either corn or soybeans since the ethanol mandate came to be. And so that's the number that we got. We also had another number in our story. For the first time in 2012, the USDA tried to get a handle on what we call new breakings or sod busting. There's a couple ways to refer to it. And in 2012 alone, they saw 38,000 acres of new breakings. And so, again, we saw exactly what you're talking about, not only in Iowa, in South Dakota, in southern Illinois, in Nebraska, in Minnesota. It's not really hard to find it if you know where to look.
Before we let you go, Dina, a new farm bill is moving at its glacial pace through Congress now. Is the idea of keeping this ethanol mandates in place, the ethanol subsidies in place, being reconsidered now?
The farm bill, I mean, I think what's being reconsidered is the renewable fuel standard, which is obviously separate of the farm bill. There is obviously a movement afoot to repeal the corn ethanol portion of the RFS. Senator Dianne Feinstein of California and Senator Coburn are working on legislation to do that. And then any day now, and I think it may be as soon as tomorrow, the EPA is going to release the volumes under the RFS for 2014. As you may have recall, and for the 2013 numbers, they already really reduced cellulosic, kind of recognizing that cellulosic wasn't quite there. But we're expecting them in the 2014 numbers actually to reduce the volumes for corn ethanol. So that's, I think, really interesting to watch. On the subsidy portion, I think there's been a recognition that this is the ethanol industry, you know, is booming. It's doing well, and I haven't heard any pushes in Washington to reinstate the subsidies.
All right, Dina, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks so much, guys. I really appreciate it.
That's Dina Capiello, national environmental reporter for the Associated Press in Washington, D.C.